This is a special edition of the Breaker.News podcast, the morning after British Columbia's 43rd general election. The morning after it rained all day in southwestern BC, but we do not know which party will reign in the legislature. It was that close. The NDP won 46 seats on October 19th, the Conservatives 45, the Greens 2, the Independents speckled throughout BC. Many of them ex-BC United candidates, well, they were all shut out. So the morning after the 2024 election is a lot like the morning after the 2017 election. The party leader who lives on Vancouver's west side loses the majority, but a Vancouver Island riding recount could decide who gets majority or not in the next edition of the legislature. That's Wanda Fuca-Malahat this time, where the NDP has a 23-vote lead as of Sunday morning. This was David Eby at NDP campaign headquarters, where he appeared humbled by the results.
We disagree on many things, John Rustad and I, there's no question. But I will absolutely acknowledge that he spoke to the frustrations of a lot of British Columbians. Frustrations about the costs of daily life, frustrations about crime and public safety. And we can agree on these things. We need to support people with the costs of daily life. We need to make life more affordable for British Columbians. And we need to make communities safe for everybody. And we will do these things. And I also tonight spoke with Sonia Furstenow. And I congratulated her on running a strong campaign, on her contributions to this province in the 2017 Parliament. And since then, she ran a strong and principled campaign, and I'm grateful for that. And there are many values that we share in common with the Green Party, and I am committed to working with them on our common shared values.
The mood was celebratory at Conservative campaign headquarters for leader John Rustad.
And I tell you something, we are so close right now. There is just a couple of seats that are just within 20, 30 votes that could very easily flip for us. There's still votes yet to be counted. And I am optimistic that the people in this province are hungry for that change. And I can tell you something, what we have seen to date, because of the work that we've been doing, because of the pressure that we're putting on this government, think about it. They flipped on the carbon tax. They flipped on decriminalization. They flipped on involuntary care. They flipped on a whole bunch of things because they could see the damage that was being done. But I bet you this, and I'll say this right now, that if we have the unfortunate situation of David Eby being in a minority government, he will not do a single thing that he has promised. And that is something I'm almost guaranteed. And as the Conservative Party of British Columbia, if we're in that situation, we are going to make it as difficult as possible for this NDP to do any more destruction of this province.
Green leader Sonia Furstenow conceded her loss in Victoria Beacon Hill, but she vowed to help the two new Green MLAs become the balance of power in the legislature.
It does appear that the Greens are still going to play a pretty pivotal role in the BC legislature. It's a strange time in politics when, during an atmospheric river, people come out and vote for a party that's denying the reality of climate change. But hey, this is where we're at. I am so excited for Jeremy Valeriot and Rob Botterill. This is incredible. This is a passing of the torch, and I am going to be there to mentor and guide and lead in any way that I can.
The Election BC final count coming on October 26th, and maybe a judicial recount after that. So we're still in a bit of a holding pattern. My guests on this special edition are Cash Heed, who is a city councillor in Richmond. He is a former Solicitor General of British Columbia when he was a member of the BC Liberal Cabinet and Caucus. And my other guest is Colleen Hardwick, a former Vancouver City Councillor and a candidate for the mayoralty of Vancouver in 2022. She's with the team for A Livable Vancouver. First, Cash, we'll go to you. What were your takeaways, your main takeaways from October 19th, from Election Day?
Well, there's a few surprises, but again, not so many surprises. Bob, you and I spoke prior to the 19th, and I gave you my prediction at that time. So it's pretty close to that. It's what's more surprising, it's so razor thin. I thought most likely that independent candidates and the Greens would hold the balance of power. It appears the Greens only may hold the balance of power going forward. So that was closer than I thought it would be. But I was surprised none of the independents really fared well at all. They may have made a difference on whether an NDP person or a Conservative candidate was elected, but they didn't play into this at all. And I was somewhat surprised. You and I talked about the fact that Vicky Huntington was probably the only independent candidate that had a real progressive chance at dealing with it. But that was due to a specific issue at that time in Delta. So not many surprises. I think the largest loser in this is David Eby.
Colleen Hardwick, what was your key takeaway or takeaways from Election Day?
Well, I'm looking at this through the lens of the city of Vancouver, of course. And overall, of course, we saw the pendulum swing, despite the fact that the campaign was nasty, American-style name-calling and outright lying and misrepresentation throughout the campaign, which was really, you know, discouraging on a lot of different levels. But in the city of Vancouver, the three key issues for me were Bill 44, the abolition of the park board, and now the by-election that will be forced because of Christine Boyle's election. So there's some big issues around democracy that come forward as a result of this election as the pendulum swings. I think because it's razor thin, we will see more balance in a way, regardless of who tips that balance, 45, 46, 47, I guess you need 47 seats to win. But it will, they won't be able to, regardless of which side it is, they won't be able to just ram through their agendas. Like we saw, for example, Bill 44 ram through. That's something that I think will come under a lot more scrutiny going forward.
Now, this happened October 19th. It was 2 years to the day that the NDP board disqualified Anjali Appadurai from the leadership race, which essentially made David Eby the premier in waiting on October 19th of 2022. That was over membership sales and support from environmental charities. But 2 years later, David Eby loses the majority in the election, even after flip-flopping on various positions, drug decriminalization, involuntary care, and the carbon tax to try to keep voters from moving over to the Conservatives. The Conservatives won back Surrey, Fraser Valley, parts of Richmond, plus parts of Northern Vancouver Island. But everybody lost something in this election. Of course, I just mentioned Eby lost the majority, lost control of Surrey, which may be the after effects of the Surrey Police Service saga. John Rastad was the biggest winner. He went from two seats to 45 over the course of 2 years, but he lost star candidates. Yuri Fulmer in West Vancouver to Jeremy Vlariot from the Greens. There were star candidates on the coast and the islands. I mean, Gwen O'Mahony in Nanaimo, former NDP MLA, Chris Sankey up on the North Coast. Those didn't make it across the finish line. The Greens lost leader Sonia Firstenau in Victoria Beacon Hill. She decided to change ridings. They also lost half their popular vote support compared to 2017, the last normal election. But they do have two seats similar to 2020. Who do you think was the biggest loser of this election? I'll start with you, Colleen.
Well, David Eby, clearly. Which hopefully will make him think twice about being an autocrat, because again, we've seen a behavior pattern develop here where he has been imposing his will on the people. And that has really played itself out, I think, in this election in a lot of ways by balancing the balance of power. But you said something, Bob, which made me wonder. You said the Conservatives won back a series of ridings, including Surrey. Well, the Conservatives didn't have them. That was the BC United come BC Liberals come going back SoCred. So I think what the inference is there was that the people across the province are balancing out their political intentions. And that's something that I see as very positive. But yeah, I think David Eby was the big loser in this.
Yeah, I do stand corrected there that the Conservatives are the standard bearer for free enterprise. That's where a lot of their support would have come from. And there's probably a lot of people who are just supporting the Conservatives because the work that Pierre Poilievre is doing for the Conservative movement federally. So absolutely, I do take that point. They didn't win back those ridings for their party or their brand, but more or less for the philosophy, the free enterprise philosophy. Now, Kashid, who do you think was the biggest loser?
Oh, David Eby, by far. And there are reasons why. And you go back to 2022 when he was, in my opinion, a little concerned about his challenger for the leadership of the NDP and the arrogance that we saw back then. I've known David Eby for years. I had a good relationship with him when he was representing Pivot in the downtown East Side in the civil liberties. But the David Eby I've seen in the political field has just been completely someone that's arrogant. Someone that, you know, it doesn't matter which road you take if you don't know where you're going. He flip-flops so much. Really, what the core principles of the NDP were lost with David Eby. David Eby, and Colleen identified this earlier, we had this American-style politics being played out here. David Eby is a classic player of it. And I'm not sure whether he even listened to any of his advisors, but I think the arrogance that came out of him really hurt him. It hurt the NDP. I think the winner, and I just want to add this, is the people in British Columbia, because we have more of a balance in place now. So the autocratic type leadership that Eby has demonstrated over the last couple of years is not going to be there. I think we're going to have more of a balanced approach, as Colleen identified, going forward. So at the end of the day, the people of BC are win. Whether they're able to hold whoever retains the power or is the powerhouse here in British Columbia will be fragile, but I think it's beneficial to the people of British Columbia.
You know, I wonder if you can compare and contrast the two main campaigns. Now, the NDP obviously had the biggest war chest by being the incumbent. They had 4 years to prepare, 2 years, you know, with David Eby as leader of the party. But the campaign was heavy on disinformation about the Conservatives. It blamed Rustad for BC Liberal government sins, even though he wasn't really leadership material when he was in cabinet. And he wasn't really a powerful cabinet minister at all. The last week of the campaign, though, Eby seemed to turn away from criticizing John Rustad and focusing on criticizing billionaire Chip Wilson and his mansion sign, and of course pointing out all the offensive social media content from various quarters within the Conservative campaign team, especially Brent Chapman in Surrey, who actually got elected. The NDP spent millions of dollars with a campaign that was quite negative and lost the outright majority. And meanwhile, you had the Conservatives on the other side of things. This was a party under John Rustad, which came from almost nowhere. They really haven't had much power for almost a century. And they were building a party while building a platform, while building a campaign. Where do you think that the NDP and the Conservatives go from a campaign standpoint to improve those parties in the eyes of the public? Because, of course, as we see, neither got a majority.
Well, let me tell you, and I just want to go back to your reference of Chip Wilson. I don't know why he was involved in this, to tell you the truth, but I think that fractured David Eby's ego. I think he's very egotistical, and I think that's why you saw the tit for tat between the individuals, and that carried on into some of the other people involved. John Rustad was a caucus member only when I was in government. He was representing a particular area. He was certainly very passionate about those particular issues, he did not have that comprehensive understanding of what needed to be done, especially when you refer to Metro Vancouver and the needs within the main populace of British Columbia here going forward. Now, David Eby is in, as I mentioned, very fragile position, because I think there's people that are going to be looking at someone else taking this. For example, if the coalition, whatever they bring together, if that's the way it has to be, does not hold, or even the majority does not hold for 16 or 18 months or something like that, and we have to go to an election, you watch the likes of Nikki Sharma and see her rise to power within that party and possibly be the next leader going forward. John Rustad will ride this out, because he's at the hierarchy of Pavlov's hierarchy right now. He'll never go any higher. So it remains to be seen what will happen with him.
Colleen Hardwick, what do you think of the future of the leaders of these two parties?
Well, I think power struggles on both sides are inevitable. With David Eby, again, his domineering attitude has off-put a lot of people. And whoever approved those commercials, I mean, it was a relentless barrage of commercials that lost a lot of people because they were just so rude and of course, full of lies and misrepresentations. And so people who normally would have, I think, gone along with NDP, I heard from more people that, you know, we've always voted NDP, but we, you know, I just can't do it this time. And it was David, it was David Eby's responsibility for that response from people. So I think it, without a doubt, and appropriately, there should be questions about his leadership. On the other hand, on the conservative side, well, it's all a new party, isn't it? And it's a small miracle, I think, the way that John pulled this all together. There was a sort of a ragtag group of candidates that came together, and how that is going to play out. Some are going to be more mature. Others have got more experience. I think it's inevitable, you know, whether you're looking at it 6 to 12 months out into the future, that there will be a settling in period there where, you know, various people's ambitions will play themselves out. There's some new young talent there that could well find itself going to the top. I think of someone like Gavin Dew, for example, who had run for the BC United leadership or BC Liberal leadership as someone that I would be watching. So, the overall thing is it's inevitable that there will be power struggles on both sides.
Well, thanks again for joining me on the podcast to Colleen Hardwick, former Vancouver City Councillor and leader of Team for Livable Vancouver. She ran in the 2022 civic election for the mayoralty of Vancouver. And Cash Heed, who is a municipal councillor in City of Richmond, former Solicitor General of British Columbia, former member of the BC Liberal Cabinet, and also former police chief in West Vancouver.
Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Bob. Great to hear from you.
Before we get to talking to Mario in depth about his thoughts, I just want to play this clip. I predicted on the Breaker.News podcast during the MMA panel with Mario Canseco and Andy Yan from Simon Fraser University's city program. I predicted, and I've got to gloat about this, predicted a 45-seat NDP minority. And it turned out to be just one shy of the result on election night, October 19th. I'll just say the NDP will win 45 seats and have a minority. And
ooh,
they'll be talking to a couple other MLAs and offer them some sweet deals to come on over to support them, conference of supply agreement or cabinet seat. Something's going to happen there. They're going to have to do some post-October 19th politicking to stay in power. Coming to the election, Mario, your poll showed a statistical tie within the margin of error. Your respondents before the election period began said 44% NDP, 42% conservative, and 10% green. By the last poll, October 18th, month later, the respondents were saying 44% NDP, conservative 41%, and on October 19th, It ended up 44.59% NDP, 43.5% Conservative, and 8.19% Green. So very, very close there. So why the day after do we have no clear winner? What was in the mind of the voters on October 19th?
Well, I think a couple of issues that are really salient looking at the way the election turned out have to do with regional breakdowns. The Fraser Valley did not hold for the NDP. They weren't able to keep some of the ridings that they won in 2020. And Surrey was a battleground that was won handily by the Conservatives. I think there was an emphasis in the final week to talk about the comments made by candidate Chapman, tried to talk about this in a way that would be enticing for Surrey voters. And a lot of them had just made up their minds before. You know, we're still in the middle of our exit poll. And what we're hearing from people is a lot of them made up their minds about who to vote for before the campaign began. And when that happens, you essentially have a group that is dead set on keeping the government or that is voting for change, even though voting for change as a motivator for Conservatives is not as high as what we saw, for instance, in Manitoba in the last election for the NDP voters, and a little bit higher than what we saw, for instance, in Alberta, where the NDP tried to change the government and couldn't. So change was a motivator, but not as heavily as the party's ideas and policies. And I think this is part of what has to be discussed. You know, it wasn't necessarily a rejection of what the government was doing that was based on whoever was carrying that mantle. I think we now have a significantly popular center-right alternative that brings us back to the days of Social Credit or the BC Liberals.
Now, your respondents to your polls also said that they felt that David Eby was better suited to be premier than John Rustad. As just a leader, an image, as well as on certain policies. What happened at the ballot box? Was this really a case of more people deciding that they thought that the Conservatives were meeting their needs or would meet their needs because of the major issues that people were concerned about? Was this really just an anti-NDP vote? Or do you think people were expressing positive feelings to the Conservatives? Which way did it go?
Well, I think there's a separate scenario where there's an emotional connection established by the leader with voters. And that would mean that we're talking about a massive Conservative government. You know, it's quite interesting to watch how the numbers were so close when it came to voting, but the emotional connection with John Rostad wasn't there. You know, he still trailed David Eby as the best premier. His approval rating was down. A lot of it is also the animosity from the NDP voter who is afraid of John Rostad. So it's a similar situation to the polarization we had. I would go back to the 2016 election in the United States, where the unfavorability of both Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton is high because whoever is voting for the other hates them. So it's a similar scenario that we're seeing here. And I think it really speaks to the need of creating a more cohesive foundation when it comes to the progressives and the center left. You know, we heard the messages yesterday. There's the expectation that the Greens are going to support the NDP if they want to form the government. What type of agreement is made is still up for debate. It will be more complicated for them to support the Conservatives unless the seats change very dramatically over the next week. But I think it also speaks about just how easy it has become to look at BC almost as an American election. I really like whoever is on my side when it comes to ideas and policies, and I really hate everybody who's on the other side. And I don't think you can point at a specific issue that changes this. I think the expectation from the NDP standpoint was these people aren't ready and they're not going to do a good job and look at the candidates that they're running. And some of the candidates that were controversial for their statements ended up losing, but others won. So we're at a post-2016 stage where whatever you say on social media is not going to affect everybody in the same fashion.
Do you think it also was a case that maybe people were less offended by the statements of certain candidates and more offended by just the general conditions of BC, that they basically discounted whatever may have been said, whatever offensive words were said by candidates that were pointed out by the NDP, and said, no, what I see, those words aren't as offensive as the fact that there's too much homelessness, the fact that there's too many drug overdoses, the fact that the NDP government doesn't really have an economic plan, and of course the fact that people are still offended by high prices for all sorts of things, taxes, as well as just the high price of living, that there's more things that people were offended by than what someone said years ago on Facebook.
I think also, aside from that, which is true, I think there's a lot of issues that certainly take precedence, and we don't see the candidate in the riding as a main motivator for a lot of voters. There's other elections where that is at 14-15%. In this one, for both conservatives and NDP voters, it's roughly at around 10%. And there's that lack of connectivity with the candidate in the riding. You had some long-serving incumbents who lost their seats. And a lot of it is not necessarily related to how people in your riding feel about you, but ultimately what the government can do and whether the sentiment for change is high. But the other thing that is quite remarkable is that the discussions about social media and mentions and things candidates said, they can move voters over 55. Young voters looked at some of the statements and go, oh, I probably said something worse when I was in university. So the more this generation grows and then becomes voters, they look at the social media snafus as something that is not going to affect the way they feel about things. And I think this is important to note. You know, we've had elections in the past where the sole mention of something even remotely controversial on social media gets you kicked out of the candidate list. John Rostad stood by Bruce Chapman, and Bruce Chapman ended up winning fairly easily in his Surrey riding.
Now, some ballots are still in play. The out-of-district ballots are what they call them. That's vote-by-mail, telephone-assisted ballots, and they were offering telephone-assisted ballots to people who couldn't get out because of the severe storms that were happening in southern BC on October 19th. And then there's also votes cast outside of voters' riding, because you can vote anywhere in BC now. They've taken the tether away from you, but those votes don't get counted on election day. So there's still some votes in play that could affect races here and there. October 26th is the final count deadline. So there's still more to go. This is a cliffhanger. We don't know exactly where it's going to end. And of course, what happens after that when the NDP and the Conservatives start to talk to the Greens, for instance, and when the legislature could be back, when there could be a confidence motion, for instance. So we still have some steps along the way before our government is stable and functioning again. What do you think is next? What are you looking for in the coming days and weeks?
Well, I think there will be endless phone calls to the two people who are right now the most important in BC politics, and those are the Greens that were elected. It's going to be a wild ride, particularly because I think there will be an opportunity to establish a different type of government. And one of the things that we asked in our exit poll is, should we just have mergers? You know, the remnants of BC United, should they just join with the BC Conservatives and we forget about this and have one center-right party? That idea is palatable, but there's more people who believe that what we should be seeing is a merger of the NDP and the Greens. I think usually we are spending time the day after elections looking at how the center-right votes could have been different if they only had unity. And now we're having the discussion related to the progressive forces. So if there's a way to create some sort of merger between the parties, and maybe something that happens before the next election, if it's something that we're thrown upon, if nobody can form the government, then that would go a long way in essentially establishing BC as more as an American state in that sense. You have a center right, you have a center left, the Greens joining with the NDP, if that's possible, and it'll make things a little bit easier, but we still have a long way to go. And I think part of this is the endorsement isn't really there in the same way that we saw in 2017 from the electorate to the forces of change. You know, we do see a drop in the level of support for the NDP. It's still one of their best results when it comes to voting intention and actual voting percentages. But it's not as evident as the drop that we saw for the BC Liberals being led under Christy Clark from 2013 to 2017. And I think this is also part of what is going to be in the minds of the lieutenant governor when she starts to think about what to do. You know, this isn't, you're not actually dropping from something that you created, which is ultimately what happened with Christy Clark in 2017. This is David Eby's first election, and I think that will be taken into consideration when they try to figure out who should form the government. I mean, the NDP will have the first crack at it. That's the way it's written. It might be enough with the support of the two Greens, but it's really tough to tell at this point.
Trudeau Liberal MPs were involved endorsing various NDP candidates, going door to door with them even. On the other hand, we didn't see an endorsement from Pierre Poilievre for the Conservatives. But there were members of the federal Conservative team who were working on the John Rastad provincial Conservative campaign, even though they're not legally aligned organizations. Was this being used as a bit of a test market for messages, for methods, for the 2025 federal campaign?
I think it's a trial run. I completely agree with that assessment. And part of what we see is the way in which the Conservatives are fighting the battles in places where they need to do better in British Columbia. It doesn't matter if they win the seats that they already have at the federal level in the interior or in the north. I think this was more a trial run for what can happen in the metro areas. And you have some incumbents who are retiring. You look at Surrey, for instance, it would be safe to assume that the federal Conservatives have it as a place where they can do remarkably better in this election than in the previous one. But one of the messages from the night for me is just how well the NDP did in the city of Vancouver. And this is usually what happens when you are able to have a message that is coherent, to talk about specific things that matter to cities. And it shows that Vancouver is going to go with whoever they like. You know, you could have assumed that because we have a mayor who's more of a center-right mentality, the Conservatives would do better, but it certainly wasn't the situation. So for the federal Conservatives, do you expend a lot of resources trying to get the two seats that the Liberals have in Vancouver, or do you go to Surrey and then try to clean house? I think it's better in the end if they try to do something like that. And we've seen the federal Conservatives polling consistently closer to 50% at the federal level, the BC Conservatives getting 42, 43% of the vote last night. There's still that gap. There's still that group of about 1 in 10 people who say, I would vote for Poilievre, but I wouldn't vote for Rostad.
I'm Bob Mackin. Thank you for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast special post-election edition. Tell me what you think. Email bob@thebreaker.news. Share it with your friends and consider supporting the Breaker.News and the podcast. Go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Join up for the free newsletter and also consider supporting thebreaker.news through Substack. Until next week.